For WBAI Pacifica Radio Evening News, this is Extinction Rebellion.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Many listeners of this program have probably heard that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is under threat of oil drilling yet again. It has been off and on for many, many years now. In fact, my very first environmental protest I ever went to was a protest to try to stop drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where I dressed up as a polar bear and protested the Bush administration. And it's still around, this issue of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Should we drill in it? Should we not drill in it? And many of the listeners of this program have probably heard that the Trump administration is attempting to organize some drilling there before they get out of office, and really right before they get out of office. So it's worth spelling out the situation there and to be clear, to be specific exactly what's going on, because I think environmental activists want to know this level of detail. So the Trump administration has announced lame duck leases for drilling rights to this wildlife refuge. The federal government owns the land, and it's the Department of the Interior that issues the leases. Now, they have announced a public comment period, which they have to have a public comment period. That ends December 17th. So by the time the show is broadcast, that will have been over. Then any time after that, they can do what's called a final notice of sales. And the sales can begin as quickly as 30 days after the end of the public comment period. So if the Department of the Interior issues the leases almost immediately after the comment period ends and the leases begin 30 days later, you could have drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as soon as January 17th. That would be the very soonest. And if everything happens instantly, that would then be 3 days of drilling before the Biden administration takes over. Now, the Biden administration, of course, gets inaugurated January 20th at noon Eastern time. So 3 days from January 17th, the lease is potentially taking effect to inauguration day. And it's a matter of some regulatory complexity, whether the Biden administration can immediately do something about that or whether it would take them a little bit of time to do something about that. So it's a serious threat, even though the timelines are narrow and sort of tight for the Trump administration, it's a serious threat to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the question is, can something delay that process and prevent these things from happening quickly? Can something delay the review process? Can something extend the public comment process? If it does go through, can Biden be persuaded to stop the situation immediately upon taking office, on inauguration day itself, perhaps? I hope there are people working within the Biden administration transition on working on how exactly to do that if he chooses to stop the drilling, if indeed drilling does start. But the question for climate activists, as I see it, is can something get in the way of the drill bits up there in Alaska for long enough for Biden to stop the situation, either down in Washington, delaying the regulatory process, or literally in the way of the drill bits up there in Alaska? It looks like it might be this crucial short window coming up, and it might unfold very fast where there's a few days or even a few hours at a crucial time that could end up saving that refuge.
You know, for centuries, the Arctic Refuge has been central to the way of life of indigenous people in the Arctic region. And so this is having such an effect on their way of life. If oil drilling rights are sold, it would disrupt, for example, the caribou's migratory patterns along with other wildlife. And the indigenous people rely on these migratory patterns and have a culture around the wildlife in this area. So it would interrupt their way of life as they prepare for sacred harvest, for example, as their ancestors have done for thousands of years. So this is really not just an attack on a culture as it is much an attack on the landscape and on the environment.
Mm-hmm. Not just animals, it's also human beings. And we care about both.
Exactly. In other news in the Arctic, you know, the Arctic is heating up and it's shifting toward a new climate, according to the authors of the Arctic Report Card. It's an assessment that was produced annually by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Speaking to the New York Times, climate specialist Rick Thoman of the University of Alaska stated that the Arctic region continues along a path that is warmer, less frozen, and biologically changed in ways that were scarcely imaginable even a century ago. Now, Thoman is one of the authors of the annual assessment. Now, the Arctic is warming faster. It's warming faster than any other region on Earth. And this warming is raising sea levels. It is affecting ocean circulation. It is playing a significant role in extreme weather all over the globe. And of course, it is affecting the way of life of the indigenous people there. Nearly everything in the Arctic, from ice and snow to human activity, is changing so quickly that there is no reason to think that in 30 years, much of anything will be as it is today, Thoman states. More than 130 experts from 15 nations contributed to this year's Arctic Report Card.
So a couple of shows ago, we mentioned a series of regulatory changes that the Trump administration was trying to put through before it left office. And many of those are being compiled by ProPublica. One of the things that they just slipped in there as a sentence or two in their write-up, but I think it's maybe the biggest thing in the whole report. Out of all the environmental regulatory changes the Trump administration is rushing to complete, I think this one could be the most consequential. In this one, pension managers would be prohibited from considering, quote, social and environmental impacts, unquote, when choosing investments. So if you're a pension fund manager, you cannot think about the social impact of what you're doing. And you cannot think about the environmental impact of what you're doing if this regulation goes into effect. That would seem to leave only short-term rate of return in a purely financial sense. Now, of course, this is like thought police. This is like prohibiting considering stuff, prohibiting thinking about stuff instead of letting them exercise their own judgment. You would have thought that free enterprise was about letting people exercise their own judgment about how they use their money or the money that they control. But that's not according to this regulation. It is more than that, though. It's more than just the thought police, because pension funds are some of the largest investors. If all of the pension managers started investing differently all at once, it would seriously shift investment markets, maybe every investment market. Now, it's not that it will automatically do that. It's not that all public pension managers will immediately alter their thinkings upon the passage of this regulation. But it can be sued if it can be demonstrated that they're considering the environmental impact of their investments. That's weird. This regulation is saying no environmental considerations in pension investing. It's a means of starving out environmental investments that might not pay off in a direct financial sense right away. If they manage to enact this and enforce it, then people doing long-term environmental work are going to find it way harder to get funding. And people doing other types of socially responsible work will also find it much harder to get funding. People doing socially responsible work that would make more money sooner if they didn't care about social responsibility. So basically all types of charity work, even if they are monetizable. Some charity work is not monetizable, but even the monetizable can't get funding either if it doesn't pay off in the short term, because there's this huge class of investors who would be prohibited from investing in them. Now, what kind of a system is that? It's not free market, because in a free market system, investors can invest as they please. It's certainly not a libertarian ideology, because that would restrict individual choices. Libertarians would say, do what you want for whatever reason you want to. They would not support this thing, it would seem. It's certainly not communism or socialism, because that's still it's still private investment. It's still private control of capital. So we're not in the realm of communism here. It is capitalism of a sort, but it's a type of managed capitalism where the state is directing investment money and preventing it from going in some directions and pushing it to go in other directions. In this case, preventing it from going into environmentally responsible directions. It's exactly the kind of thing that the U.S. political class criticizes China for doing. And yet, here it is, right on Wall Street, coming from the U.S., coming from Washington, D.C. Now, we can debate the merits of whether the government should direct financial investing, and if they should, how they should do it. But even if we think they should, with this rule, they're pushing the investing in the wrong direction. If we go by rudimentary kindergarten level morality, considering social impact is a good thing. Considering environmental impact is a good thing. Back in nursery school, we all learned you're supposed to be nice to others and not destroy your surroundings. And here, the White House is telling us that we should ignore all that and we should decide how to spend billions of dollars. Thou shalt pursue only immediate financial profit, regardless of what it does to society and regardless of what it does to the environment. At least it's madness.
is madness.
Sheer madness.
It's also controlling public servants' money, their retirement money, and how they can determine whether or not they want their pension funds to actually be environmentally responsible. You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio for WBAI News with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Switching gears now from our discussion of recent climate news, no doubt you have heard that the Electoral College has certified Joe Biden's win. This might be a good time to talk about what has transpired over the last few weeks. When during the first presidential debate, Donald Trump instructed the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by, he did so moments after he and Joe Biden debated climate change. Although climate activists decried Trump's call out to these violent far-right white nationalists, activists were generally pleased that the topic of climate change finally took center stage in a presidential debate. It was a big deal. Like so many others who watched the two men spar, climate activists treated the candidates' exchange on climate change as if separate from Donald Trump's call out to the Proud Boys. Activists focused instead on the fact that Biden rejected the Green New Deal and said he supported instead the Biden plan.
The Green New Deal will pay for itself as we move forward. You're not going to build plants that, in fact, are great polluting plants.
But do you support the Green New Deal?
Pardon me?
Do you support
that? No, I don't support the Green New Deal.
Oh, you don't? Oh, well, that's a big statement.
I support
that means you just the radical left.
I support the Biden plan that I put forward.
Okay.
The Biden plan, which is different than what he calls the radical Green New Deal.
Since that debate, Joe Biden won the election. And yet Trump has unrelentingly contested its results through the courts, in conservative media, on Twitter, and during post-election rallies. Along with GOP state and federal representatives, he has sown doubts about the legitimacy of the election, so much so that in a recent poll, 72% of Republicans believe the election was rigged. They believe this in spite of the fact that state and federal courts have rejected Trump's fraud claims on their merits, right? And just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take up a suit filed by several GOP attorney generals with the backing of 117 GOP members of the House of Representatives to challenge the elections in the key swing states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia. The Proud Boys, whom Trump called upon during the presidential debate, have been in the streets attacking bystanders, ripping Black Lives Matter banners from churches, fighting anti-fascists and advocating for martial law in order to prevent Biden from assuming office. Inauguration Day is a month away, and in spite of insurmountable setbacks, Trump persists in his effort to debunk the election and has shown no inclination to accept defeat. This past Monday, the Electoral College confirmed Joe Biden's victory, and still Trump and his supporters continue to charge election fraud. Even as these attacks on our democracy continue unabated, climate activists have yet to address the implications for averting climate catastrophe, you know, whether through the Biden plan, the Green New Deal, or climate plan, even more revolutionary than either of these frameworks. They have yet to address the implications of the GOP's and the Trump administration's anti-democratic actions. Indeed, we have yet to ask what it would mean if we failed to avert climate catastrophe and the dissolution of our democracy, as well as what it requires for us to avert both. But these are questions we absolutely need to ask. And we need to ask them now.
The revolutionary aims of a comprehensive Green New Deal
necessary for a chance of averting apocalyptic scenarios
require a democratic revolution.
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 It's really about transforming the economy and making it fairer, right? So it's battling poverty, it's battling racism, it's battling all forms of inequality and exclusion at the same time as we radically lower our emissions. Because we do know that if we are going to lower our emissions in time, it is going to take transformations of how we live in cities, how we move ourselves around, how we grow our food, where we get our energy from. So essentially what the Green New Deal is saying, if we're going to do all that, why wouldn't we tackle all of these systemic economic and social crises at the same time? Because we live in a time of multiple overlapping crises.
I look out there, this is the time of, you know, catastrophes of biblical proportions, if we are going to call it that. You know, to the south, you have the great floods. To the west, the entire West Coast is on fire. To the north, the ice is melting and polar bears are eating each other. And to the east, you have a crazy man with orange hair whose, you know, theme song seems to be Talking Heads burning down the house. You know, I mean, I have no idea. That is catastrophe in itself, you know. And so I look out there, you know, as an indigenous person, our prophecies talk about this time. I can tell you that. I can say, we told you so. You know, for the past, you know, 100 years, we've been saying, you know, for the past 100 years, we've been saying, you know, in the time of the seventh fire, you're going to have to make a choice between two paths. One well-worn and scorched and the other not. And that is this moment.
There is a psychotic refusal to understand that the survival of the species and is connected to the survival of the planet.
One of the things about history is that it is often revisionist. You know, Martin Luther King is cast as this angelic person that never made anyone mad and just asked for civil rights and got it. And unions were always just seen as like this great, powerful thing that nobody died for a 40-hour work week and a weekend. With the New Deal is that we act as though the New Deal wasn't racist. And the New Deal was an extremely economically racist policy that drew literal red lines around Black and brown communities. And basically, it invested in white America. And what it did was that it allowed white Americans to have access to home loans that Black and brown Americans did not have access to, giving them the largest form of intergenerational wealth, which is real estate. And so this has really, it really accelerated many parts of an already horrific racial wealth gap that continues to persist today. So this is why the intersectional frontline community aspect of the Green New Deal is so important.
A lot of the people who are dying from fossil fuel pollution or who are carrying the heaviest burden are people of color, and they're poor people of color. And likely when climate change picks up and we see more disasters, more deaths, those are the first people who are on the line. People like to say climate change will kill us all, but the truth is climate change will kill some people first.
Something like a Green New Deal in this country that is actually putting forward a vision for how we tackle both the injustices of the climate crisis and economic inequality and racial injustice at the same time and not see these issues as separate.
Because it allows Indigenous communities to lead, Black and brown communities to have a certain self-determination that has not existed in public policy for these communities before. And so one of the ways that we do that is we say we fix the pipes in Flint first. We clean the air in the Bronx first. We rebuild the electrical grids in Puerto Rico, and we fully fund we fully fund the pensions of coal miners in West Virginia at the same time. And the reason that we do these things is because the truth of the matter is that economically, civically, and beyond, our destinies and our prosperity and our well-being is tied. It's inextricably linked. And when we pursue public policy in a way that unlinks us from each other, it is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. Eventually, it catches up to you. And it catches up to you in racial resentment, that racial resentment is the political tool to dismantle the economic advocacy that we need to have for ourselves.
Given how far we are from realizing anything close to such a vision, all this might understandably induce despair.
And yet,
even if such a revolutionary movement is exceedingly unlikely to succeed within the short time frame we have.
Even if it is too late to prevent runaway warming and some sort of global collapse.
This revolution will still be worth fighting and sacrificing for, even dying for.
And it always has been.
Are unstoppable. A better world is possible. We are unstoppable. A better world is possible.
Documents obtained by The Guardian reveal that a group of U.S. environmental activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience targeting the oil industry have been listed in internal Department of Homeland Security documents as quote-unquote extremists, and some of its members listed alongside white nationalists and mass killers.
Abolish the police!
The Intercept reported that two women who vandalized the Dakota Access Pipeline in an effort to halt construction have been indicted on charges that carry up to 110 years in prison and hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. They are among the harshest penalties environmental activists have faced in the last decade. Civil liberties lawyers say the charges are in line with industry-inspired scare tactics meant to deter citizens from participating in direct action protests or acts of sabotage against oil and gas companies.
The Guardian newspaper is reporting the FBI kept files on a number of climate activists connected to the group 350.org. The files date from 2016, when 350.org was helping to organize the Break Free from Fossil Fuels campaign. While names have been redacted, the documents make reference to three peaceful protesters from Iowa who were arrested in Indiana while protesting at a BP refinery.
Abolish the police!
Because the only thing more horrific than runaway climate catastrophe
is the very real prospect of living into it within mere decades under a racist, nationalist, militarized, oligarchic political system
that is leading us toward, if not already becoming, an authoritarian police state. The only thing worse than climate catastrophe is climate catastrophe plus fascism.
La seule chose pire que le changement de climat est le changement de climat plus le fascisme.
تنها چیزی که از بحران اقلیمی بدتره بحران اقلیمی و فاشیسم با همه.
Es ist nur eine Sache schlimmer als die Klimakatastrophe. Und das ist die Klimakatastrophe und Faschismus.
Lo único peor que la catástrofe climática es la catástrofe climática más el fascismo.
الأسوأ من تغيير المناخ هو تغيير المناخ بالإضافة إلى الفاشية.
جلوائي پریورتن کی کسی اپاتکال سے کئی زیادہ نقصان دائق ہے. جلوائی پریورتن کا کوئی اپاتکال اور اس کے ساتھ کیسے سپاہ؟
Única coisa pior que desastre de clima é desastre de clima com fascismo.
The only thing worse than climate catastrophe is climate catastrophe plus fascism.
Let the rebellion begin. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to the following people for sound editing: Roshi Sirjani, Cheyenne Tang, and James Sirone. For promotional materials, thanks to April Goldberg and Allie Page. Thanks to Wen Stevenson for his quote on climate change and those who read it: Ingrid, Ambrose, Zaida, Spencer, April, and Wen. And thanks to those who read it in languages other than English: Yasmin, Roshi, Han, Elka, Sharifa, Miguel, and Kiani. Thanks once more for listening.